ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय Shri Radha Gopinath Ki Jai. So we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 5, Chapter 7, and we'll be starting this chapter today. So each chapter always starts with a little summary of the chapter. I'll start reading that. Chapter 7 is entitled The Activities of King Bharata. In this chapter, the activities of King Bharat Maharaj, the emperor of the whole world, are described. Bharat Maharaj performed various ritualistic ceremonies, Vedic yagyas, and satisfied the Supreme Lord by his different modes of worship. In due course of time, he left home and resided in Hardva and passed his days in devotional activities. Being ordered by his father, Lord Rishabhdev, Bharat Maharaj married Panchajani, the daughter of Vishwarup. After this, he ruled the whole world peacefully. Formerly, this planet was known as Ajanaba, and after the reign of Bharat Maharaj, it became known as Bharatvarsha. Bharat Maharaj begat 5 sons in the womb of Panchajani and named the sons Sumati, Rashtrabhrita, Sudarshan, Avarana, and Dhumraketu. Bharat Maharaj was very rigid in executing religious principles and following in the footsteps of his father. He therefore ruled the citizens very successfully. Because he performed various yagyas to satisfy the Supreme Lord, he was personally very satisfied. Being of undisturbed mind, he increased his devotional activities unto Lord Vasudev. Bharat Maharaj was competent in understanding the principles of saintly persons like Narada, and he followed in the footsteps of the sages. He also kept Lord Vasudev constantly within his heart. After finishing his kingly duties, he divided his kingdom among his 5 sons. He then left home and went to the place of Pulaha, known as Pulaha Ashram. There he ate forest vegetables and fruits and worshipped Lord Vasudev with everything available. Thus he increased his devotion toward Vasudev and he automatically began to realize further his transcendental blissful life. Due to his highly advanced spiritual position, there were sometimes visible in his body the ashta-sattvika transformation, such as ecstatic crying and bodily trembling, which are symptoms of love of Godhead. It is understood that Maharaj Bharat worshipped the Supreme Lord with the mantras mentioned in the Rig Veda, generally known as Gayatri Mantra, which aim at the Supreme Narayan situated within the sun. I will also read the translations of the first 3 verses, since there's no purport. And also there's no verse written because the Sanskrit is prose. It's not in the meter that we can chant. So I'll just read the translations and then try to say something. Text 1. Shukadev Goswami continued speaking to Maharaj Parikshit. My dear king, Bharat Maharaj was a topmost devotee, following the orders of his father, who had already decided to install him on the throne. He began to rule the earth accordingly. When Bharat Maharaj ruled the entire globe, he followed the orders of his father and married Panchajani, the daughter of Vishwarup. Text 2. Just as the false ego creates the subtle sense objects, Maharaj Bharata created 5 sons in the womb of Panchajani, his wife. These sons were named Sumati, Rashtrabhrita, Sudarshan, Avarana, and Dhumraketu. And text 3. Formerly, this planet was known as Ajanaba Varsha, but since Maharaj Bharata's reign, it has become known as Bharat Varsha. Purport. This planet was formerly known as Ajanaba because of the reign of King Nabi. After Bharat Maharaj ruled this planet, it became celebrated as Bharat Varsha. Om agyanti mirandasya gyananjana chalakaya chakshurun militam yena tasmai shri gurave namaha shri chaitanya mano bhishtam stapitam yena bhutale svayam rupa kadamayam dadati svapadantikam shri krishna chaitanya prabhu nityananda shri advaita gadadhara shri vasadi gaura bhaktavrinda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Okay. So we'll be starting a new chapter today, and also a new topic, continuing with last week's readings. We'll start the story of Bharat Maharaj, and I think this is a very important and a very instructive story for all of us as it unfolds in the next coming chapters, in the next, I think, 3 or 4 chapters. We'll be learning important lessons for our spiritual life, and I was thinking about talking a little bit about the nature of fall down and the phenomena of fall down, which can happen to all of us. And I think this is one of the lessons that we learn from the story of Bharat Maharaj, and then also of how we can protect ourselves from that. As we know, Bharat Maharaj was a very famous king. It's said here in this verse that before Bharat Maharaj was ruling the kingdom was known as Ajanabha Varsha, because of King Nabha and his activities. So we see that if somebody does something great in the world, then things, statues, shopping malls, colleges, universities, whatever, are being named after these personalities. So we have so many different things glorifying or remembering, commemorating the activities of personalities that did something great in this world. So in a similar way, also Bharat Maharaj, he was a great king, he was a very pious ruler, he was charitable, he was following in the footsteps of his father, his grandfather that we had discussed earlier, Maharaj Pritavrata, Rishabdev, all these personalities that left a great legacy. And so he was following in their footsteps, and obviously the citizens loved him and appreciated his service, otherwise they wouldn't have wanted to remember him forever and name the land Bharat Varsha, and it's still known today. India is still known as Bharat Varsha, still worshipped in different capacities as such. So yeah, but that's not the reason why he's in the Srimad Bhagavatam. There's so many people who do so many amazing things in this world, but the reason why he's in the Srimad Bhagavatam is because he's such a great devotee, and he has a very unique path of reaching the lotus feet of the Lord. And I think all the stories in the Bhagavatam are meant to instruct us and to inspire us in our spiritual life, and also to glorify, of course, the devotees. So, yeah, as I said, one of the important lessons we can learn from Bharat Maharaj is to be careful in spiritual life. Obviously, you know, he set an example for us. And yeah, I just want to talk about that a little bit. We know later on, as the story develops, we hear Prabhupada explaining that Bharat Maharaj actually attained the platform of bhava, which is a very exalted state in spiritual life. Bhava is considered to be the goal, the first step of the goal in our spiritual life. There's sadhana bhakti, which goes from up to the stage of huchi. You know, we're familiar with the 9 stages of devotional service, starting from Shraddha to Prem. So the first stages are considered to be sadhana bhakti, or devotional service and practice. And then once we get to the platform of bhava or prema, then we achieved our goal. So it's not just an ordinary state. Within those nine stages of devotional service, I think the longest time we spend is on the platform of bhava. Anartanivritti. Our acharyas explain that we spend most of our time trying to purify ourselves from unwanted habits in our heart. And the acharyas explain that we can spend lifetimes actually on that particular stage. So once we succeed going beyond that, then we come to the platform of nishta, which means steadiness. And then at that point, there's nothing that can shake our determination, our devotion, our level of absorption. So at that point, we are fixed in devotional service. And then after that is ruchi, or a natural attraction to serving the Lord is going to develop in our hearts. And then after that, we reach the platform of bhava eventually, which is the first sprout. It's explained in Nectar of Devotion that bhava is the first sprout of the plant, the flower of devotional service. So you have a sprout, and you know, it's just a matter of time when the flower fully blossoms. And it's also compared to the sun, to sunrise. Every morning we have a beautiful sunrise here. Like the first rays of the sun, they start to lighten up everything. And you know the sun is coming. It's just not quite there yet. So bhava is compared to this, the first rays of the sun in the morning, and you know the sun is going to come. So it's a very exalted stage, but even at that stage, there's danger to fall down. And then Madhurya Kadambini Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, he explains that until we actually are at the lotus feet of Krishna, there's always some chance to deviate from devotional service. So, to remind ourselves that we are tatastha shakti, we are in the marginal energy of the Lord. There are different living entities, and there's matter or non-living entities. And the living entities we are in the category of tatastha shakti. Of course, there's Vishnu tattva, there's Krishna with all his expansions, incarnations. And he's considered to be, or he's called Achyuta, or infallible. Krishna is beyond the modes. He's in Vishuddha sattva. He's not affected by the material energy. And unlike us, we are just, compared to him, we are just infinitesimal. Prabhupada explains that the size of the soul is 1/10,000th the size of the tip of a hair. So you all know how big a hair is. And if you split that in 10,000 particles, then this is the size of the soul, so there's every chance for us to be swept by the material energy. And so also tatastha shakti means it's like the shoreline. So we either have the chance to be, on the beach, you have the beach, you have the sand, and then you have the ocean. So tatastha means the shoreline, just where the ocean meets the beach. So there's always a chance for us to be either on the beach or in the ocean. So we can always be in either one of those realms. Just to keep that in mind, that we are tiny. Sometimes it doesn't seem like that, but especially when we have some sort of achievements in this world, it feels like we are in control and we are in charge and we can manipulate something. But it's just a matter of time, usually, when Krishna shows us, if he's kind, that actually, that's not the case. We've just discussed, we just had a 2 weeks course on Vedanta. So we discussed the different acharyas' understanding of the relationship between us, the living entities, and the Lord, and the material nature. So, of course, Shankara says that there's only Brahman and everything else doesn't really exist. Everything, every distinction is just an illusion, something that happens on the Vyavaharika platform or on the temporary platform, on the material platform, which also doesn't really exist. As such, it's just a cognitive mistake that we think there is distinction. But all the Vaishnava acharyas, of course, as we know, they counteract that and they say, no, there's a real distinction between the living entities, between Brahman and between the world. And especially Madhva Acharya, who is the Acharya in our Sampradaya, via the Brahma Madhva Gaudiya Sampradaya. So it starts with Madhva Acharya. And he stresses very strongly that there's a distinction between the living entity and the Lord, between living entities themselves, between living entities and the world, and between Prakriti itself. So there are eternal distinctions. And also what's important to understand, let me talk about Sambandha Gyan, is not just the nature of the living entities, the nature of matter, and the nature of the Lord, but also the different relationships between all of them. So we want to understand our relationship with the material world. Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita that the material world is an inferior energy. The living entities are superior energy, and the matter is inferior energy. And also we want to understand the relationship between the living entities to each other and between the living entities and the Lord. So the living entities, as our acharyas point out, we are eternal servants of Krishna. And so unless we have that concept fully realized or understood, imbibed, there's always a chance of fall down. Because this means that we are not properly situated in our constitutional position. The function of something can be explained or analyzed by the way for which, but the purpose for which it was created. So if you, for instance, look at this little table here, you know it's made for sitting here and giving a class, right? So it's facilitating holding books, and there's a little watch here, reminding the speaker when to stop and when to start as well. And so there's all sorts of little arrangements here, which is quite intriguing. It's probably the nicest table, anyway, I've seen in ISKCON. So there's a purpose to it, and it was created for the purpose of sitting here and facilitating the Bhagavatam class. So in a similar way, so it's made for that, so this is the nature of the table. In a similar way, we are meant for serving the Lord, and so if you understand the purpose of something, then we understand also the nature of itself or the definition of an object. And also one of our qualities is that we are, as I said earlier, tiny, and we can fall down. So I was just thinking about the nature of gravity just in this world, for instance. If you let something fall down, it'll naturally go down. So naturally, if you throw something up, eventually it comes back down again. Also, if I was to throw, or just not even throw, but to drop something on the floor, no matter how heavy it is, it'll fall with the same velocity. And I think gravity, for those of you who are scientists, 9.81 meters per square second. I think that's the velocity of, right? Did I get that right? Okay. That's the velocity of gravity, the power, the force that pulls everything down. And in a similar way, we also naturally have the tendency to go down if you don't do anything about it. And I was thinking also that little children, for instance, when a child is born, it's in the horizontal position, right? So then naturally, the tendency is that it wants to go up. So, it starts to walk. We see little, we have so many children here. And I see Ramani more often, so I see how she's developing. And so, first she sits and it goes up. There's an inherent tendency, a desire to go up. And then she starts to walk and she runs around and then she grows until whatever, we are 16 or 18 or whatever, whenever we stop growing. And then we kind of hit the roof or ceiling and from which we can't grow any further. And then, we grow. We stop growing. We just are until we are, 40 or 50. And then we start going down again. And you see older people sometimes, they kind of get smaller or shorter. Also, there's different physiological functions going on that cause that. But eventually, we go down again, and by the time we die, it's again in the horizontal position. So there's a kind of a cycle there. We go up for a while and then we go down again. We can see this with so many different things. I think there was a study done This was some years ago. I don't know what's the recent number of years. Maybe somebody can help. But they made a survey about businesses, like big corporations, and they said that the maximum amount of years that the business can last is, I think it was 44 years. So within 44 years, the business goes up, stays, and eventually it comes down again. So if you look at businesses that existed whatever 50 years ago, many of them, they're not here anymore. And Prabhupada, so yeah, I don't know if there's some more recent studies that suggest different numbers, but the idea is that in the material world, things grow and then they decline again, just the nature of gravity that pulls everything down again. And Prabhupada says in one of his diary entries, after he took sannyas, he says that what remains is just a list of names. So he talks about family, he talks about previous relationships that he had, but it's all that's left is just a list of names. You know, if you see great personalities doing something, well, you know, it's written in history books, but that's all that's left. So also we can see that in spiritual life, that if you don't endeavor, if you don't keep struggling, if you don't keep, endeavoring, then we'll be declining in our spiritual lives. And that's also connected to Lord Balaram, who's in charge, actually. He's the presiding deity of gravity. He's in charge of that. And spiritual, like, gravity works like a straight line, right? Like if you drop something, it goes down. Like spiritual life is not as straight. Like if we start neglecting our duties, it kind of, you know, goes very gradual. It's like you're kind of sliding. And usually people initially don't notice because there's still some external activities that we do. But then internally we usually know if we do something wrong or if we keep drifting away from our principles, from our commitments, then we usually notice. And then it's kind of a gradual downward movement. It's kind of like a sliding movement. And this is what happened to Bharat Maharaj. He was getting attached to a deer. It started off really innocently, but eventually he was so attached to the deer that he became so attached to this deer that he couldn't even focus on his spiritual performances anymore. He couldn't even get absorbed in doing his puja, his whatever, his chanting, meditations. He couldn't even do that anymore. He was just thinking about the deer, and one day the deer didn't show up. And so all he could think about was the deer, so he goes out looking for the deer and eventually leaves his body thinking about the deer. So the result of that is that he has to take birth again as a deer, has to take the body of a deer again. So, of course, you know, he was so exalted, he could remember his life or his spiritual achievements in his next life. So, you know, it ends up all glorious. But again, the lesson here for us is to when we notice we slide down or we go in a certain direction, we want to rectify that as soon as possible. And one of Bharat Maharaj's shortcomings, I guess, was that, or perceived as such, was that he didn't stay in the association of devotees. And I think that's an important lesson for us, too, that we remain in the association of devotees who can point out either directly, indirectly, in different ways, of where we are sliding down. Because if we keep hearing, if we keep chanting, then we'll be reminded over and over again to, like, oh, okay, this is, you know, I'm kind of getting off track here. Whereas if you stay in our own little world, it can go so easy that we justify our, you know, desires, we justify our different opinions and say, no, this is actually the right thing, and then we just slide down. So that's an important principle, to always remain in the association of devotees who, you know, can keep us on track. And but it's a struggle, and it's like swimming upriver makes spiritual life sometimes, because the mind has a tendency to, you know, go off, go in all sorts of directions, justify all sorts of, you know, desires, things. We think, no, that's, you know, the right thing to do. And you know, there's Maya is giving us a lot of opportunities to do so, to, you know, think that, you know, doing something, you know, it's the right thing, it's in the name of Krishna consciousness, and, you know, we can still, you know, be devotees, and it's just part of being a devotee. But if we stay in the association of devotees, especially of those devotees who don't share the same anardas with us, I think the tendency also in this world is that we group together with devotees who have the same maybe misconceptions or the same anardas, so that you can encourage each other in that, because the nature of our nature is that we don't really want to be confronted. We want kind of a comfortable life, you know, which is nice. You always group together people that are like-minded. But sometimes it's nice to be in the association of people who think differently and who understand maybe the scriptures differently, to be challenged again. Who's like, oh, wait, am I understanding this properly? Am I applying this properly? And I think that's something we try to avoid sometimes by staying in the association of devotees that have a similar, even anartha on different levels, like more subtle or more externally developed. So even Srila Prabhupada, I mean, not to speak of us, but even Srila Prabhupada was still praying, please Krishna, protect me from falling down. Please Krishna, just protect me from Maya. So if Prabhupada prays like that, then what's our position in this world? So we can't actually ever be quite comfortable in this material world trying to practice spiritual life. The main enemy I think that we encounter is complacency. And you know, as soon as we feel comfortable in a certain situation, then we're like, okay, you know, this is a nice situation. I kind of, you know, have a stable situation, stable, steady life, which is nice. And it's definitely desire to come to a more sattvic life in a mode of goodness, where you have like a steadiness and a stable situation. But for our spiritual life internally, we still need to keep fighting, we still need to struggle, we still need to endeavor. And spiritual life is very dynamic. There's no stagnation in spiritual life. It either goes up or goes down. But you can't really stay on the same level spiritually for a long time, because it's all about relationships. And relationships, a relationship with Krishna is dynamic. So we always either, you know, go up or go down, go closer to Krishna or go further away from him. That always requires some endeavor, unless we are on a platform of natural attraction, where that becomes our natural liking. One example from the scriptures that gives us an idea of how we can't be complacent that I was thinking of was Dhruva Maharaj. When he's fighting against the Yakshas, he is put in a situation at some point where they fight him with like all sorts of illusions. So he's in this forest of all these appearances, and he's completely bewildered. He doesn't really know what to do, and he doesn't know really whom to fight. He doesn't see his enemy. And then he remembers, oh, you have to pray to Narayan. You have to remember Narayan in order for clarity to come again. So he remembers Narayan, and suddenly all the yakshas disappear, all the illusions disappear. You can see the forest again, and it seems to be a nice situation. You know, it's like, you know, there's some problems. You go to Krishna, whatever. Krishna is sort of creating some clarity, and then, you know, it's like, oh, it's nice, okay. But even then, Dhruva Maharaj didn't feel complacent, because he knew the yakshas are going to attack again. And they did. They just gathered to get ready for another attack. So then the yakshas again came and attacked Dhruva Maharaj. But because he was prepared, he wasn't overtaken, or he wasn't defeated by them. So Dhruva Maharaj was ready. He wasn't complacent. And he was a good example of somebody who's determined. Of course, this is what he's known for. And another king that I was thinking of from perhaps, well, more recent times, who had this enthusiasm, this determination, and this vitality in spiritual life, was King Kulashekar. And, of course, we hear about him very often. Our Acharya Srila Prabhupada is very fond of quoting his verses, his writings. And there's a famous incident, of course, where Kula Shekhar Maharaj, he's such a devotee of Lord Ram. Every day he's reading, he has the Vaishnavas in his court. So every day he's reading or hearing about the pastimes of Krishna, the pastimes of Lord Ramachandra. And he spends most of his time actually with the Vaishnavas. And the ministers in his kingdom already get a little worried, but you know, he still manages to rule the kingdom, but he just wants to hear about Krishna's pastimes, specifically Lord Ram's pastimes. So every day he has a reading from Ramayana, somebody reading the Ramayana from him, and he gets so absorbed that when he hears the Ramayana, he actually imagines it or thinks it or is convinced that it's happening right now. So even this took place like millions of years ago, but still, when he hears that Ram does something, then it's like, oh, Ram is doing this right now. He's so absorbed, and that's the nature of love. This is where we want to get to, where we hear Krishna's pastimes. And we want to, because they're eternal, they're taking place all the time anyway, so we want to get so absorbed in those pastimes that they become our reality. And it's not that our reality becomes Krishna's reality, but we want Krishna's reality to become our reality. That's spiritual life. And so one time he was hearing the pastime of when Ramchandra gets attacked by 14,000 rakshasas after Suparnaka comes and she wants to claim Ram, she wants to enjoy with Ram. Ram is getting annoyed and he asks Lakshman, okay, Lakshman, you know, you do something. And Lakshman cuts off the nose of Suparnaka. And, you know, as we know, even Rakshasa women, they like to sit in front of the mirror and think that they're beautiful. And so she was pretty upset about that, obviously. If your nose is cut off, then that's not exactly, what you would do to enhance your beauty, obviously. So she's upset and she tells her brother Ravana about it. And he starts to mobilize an army of 14,000 Rakshasas to attack Lord Ramachandra. And also he wants to kidnap Sita eventually. So when Ram does, he says, okay, Lakshman, you take care of Sita, you hide her somewhere, you protect her, and I can deal with that myself. I mean, 14,000 Rakshasas, that's not a problem for Lord Ramachandra. So Lakshman, he brings Sita into a cave and waits in front of the cave, guards the cave. And so when King Kulashekhar hears the story, he gets so furious. He gets so enthusiastic about it. He's like, yes, Ramchandra is alone by himself. He's going to fight the Rakshasas by himself. I have to go help him. So he mobilizes his entire army and goes out and goes from the Chera kingdom where he was ruling is in what's now known as Karnataka. And so he goes all the way up to Maharashtra where Ram was residing. So it's a long walk, if you have a little bit of an idea of the geography of India, it's a long walk. He mobilizes his entire army and gets everybody to walk to Maharashtra to help Lord Ram fighting the Rakshasas. And the ministers were like, oh my God, what are we going to do here? This is not actually happening in everybody else's reality, it's just happening for him, and now he's mobilizing the entire kingdom to go to Maharashtra. And so they devised a plan, they sent somebody ahead, and then the people came back, kind of messengers, and said, okay, it's done. Ram has defeated everybody single-handedly. There's no need to go there anymore and fight. You can go back. And so the king is all excited and happy. He's like, yes, Ram won. Great. And he comes back to the kingdom. And then the ministers devise another plan, and they talk to the reader, who every day reads the Ramayana to Kulashekhar. And they tell him that You can't read the bad parts. You can't read the parts where something happens to Sita Aram. Just skip those parts. Just read the good parts, the nice parts. So that's what happens. And so they read all the glorious activities that Ram performs. And again, Kulashekhar is so absorbed in the pastime that he is having celebrations and festivals every day because in the whole kingdom because of the glorious activities that Ram performs. So he celebrates that every day. There's a big festival. And until one day, of course, the reader had to go to some other place. He couldn't read. And he sent his son to read. But he didn't tell him not to read, to skip over the bad parts. And so the son, he was reading, different pastimes. And then he comes to the point, the crux of the story, I think, where Ravana kidnaps Sita. And so he kills Jatayu and he kidnaps Sita. And Kulashekhar Maharaj was so furious about hearing that. So again, he mobilized his entire army and he wants to go to Sri Lanka. And he marches with his army to Sri Lanka and wants to rescue Sita. He's determined, Sita, I'm going to come, I rescue you single-handedly, and I'll kill all these people in Sri Lanka, and I kill Ravana, and I will help Ram, and I will help you. And so he's going to Sri Lanka, and again, the ministers didn't know what to think and what to say about that. And so, yeah, they just let him go. And so they reached the ocean, and they were stand at the shore of the ocean, but Bharat Maharaj didn't even realize that there was water. He was just like with his sword over his head. He was just marching towards Sri Lanka, and he was actually entering the ocean and going into the water. Kept going until the water was up to his neck, and he still kept going. He didn't realize even externally that there was obstacles. He was so determined in his devotional service. He was so absorbed. So external obstacles didn't hold him back. So until actually he got a direct darshan of Lord Ram, so Ram himself had to come and tell them, it's fine, there's no problem, Sita is saved, Bibhishan is in charge now, he's good, they're all devotees, there's no problem anymore, I'm fine, Sita is good, and he personally takes Kulashekhar back to the shore and saves him. So then Kulashekhar again goes back to his kingdom with all his ministers and army. And then the ministers become really worried. They think like, oh my God, our king has become crazy. He's mad. How do we rule the kingdom like that? And so they were thinking about a plan on how to save him. They were like, okay, we can't send the Vaishnavas away. Because he was so fond of associating with the Vaishnavas. And they thought that the cause of his madness is his association with the Vaishnavas. So they said, okay, if he sent the Vaishnavas away, our king will go also. He was already talking about going to Sri Rangam, renouncing the world, and just living in Sri Rangam and worshipping Lord Ranganath. So he said, they thought that if he sent the Vaishnavas out of the country, we lose our king. Now, if the Vaishnavas stay in the country, we lose our king too. He's just going mad and just being so absorbed in the pastimes. And so they thought they would devise a plan to break the king's faith in the Vaishnavas. So they thought that if the king doesn't want to associate with the Vaishnavas anymore, then the problem is solved and he just can rule, continue to rule. So they were slandering the reputation of the Vaishnavas by telling a lie. They told the king, the Vaishnavas have stolen some jewelry from your deity. So they're the only ones with access to the deity's jewelry. So they must have stolen some necklace, some diamond necklace, which was lost. And so they presented that to the king, and the king immediately was like, nope, I don't believe it. The Vaishnavas, a lover of God, somebody who's a devotee of the Lord, can never do such a thing. A devotee of the Lord can never steal the Lord's property, because the devotee always just wants to serve the Lord. So I know the Vaishnavas would never do such a thing. And he was so convinced about the glories of the Vaishnavas that he called for a basket with a venomous snake, the poisonous snake. And he said, the basket came with the snake, and he's like, I'm going to put my arm into this basket, and if the Vaishnavas are innocent, nothing is going to happen. If the Vaishnavas did steal the jewelry, then my life should be over too, and then that's okay. Then my life should be over. And so he puts his arm into the basket. Nothing happens. He proves that the Vaishnavas are innocent in that way, and the ministers were so kind of shocked by him being so radical about this and so dramatic about it, that they apologized immediately. And I was like, actually, you know, it was our plot, but we just don't know what to do with you anymore. We need you to rule the kingdom, and, you know, if you just go on these excursions all the time, it doesn't really work. It doesn't help us to, you know, have a stable kingdom. We just try to devise a plan, come up with something to have you back as a king. And so then the king, you know, of course he forgave them. He's like, ministers, he didn't punish them or anything. But he was thinking that if that's my association, if this is the people that I'm working with, then I better don't want to work in this situation anymore. So this was actually one of the incidents that helped him to make a final decision to leave his kingdom. So he installed his son as the king, and he went to Sri Rangam and just worshipped the Lord like that. So that's another example of a king who was very enthusiastic and determined in his spiritual life. This is all that I wanted to talk about. One of the lessons that we can learn from Bharat Maharaj's example, the tendency that we are all fallible and we are all easily influenced by the material energy, and then how we can overcome it by enthusiasm and absorption in spiritual life and serving the Lord, serving his devotees. And of course, for us, the most important practice is chanting of the holy names, what Prabhupada has come to give us. The easiest way to absorb our minds, the chanting of the holy names. So, if there's any comments, questions, corrections, please. I just want to repeat the question. The question is, spiritual life is dynamic and it goes either up or down, and what does it mean to continuously going up? Right? Do we have to increase the quantity or the quality of our service? And I think, most of us will be like, oh gosh, more service. right? Do we have to do more service to keep going up? I think that depends on the level where we are at the moment. I mean, if you don't do any service, maybe it's a good idea to start doing some service. But if you're already fully engaged in serving the Lord, it's really more an internal struggle that we need to keep endeavoring internally for increasing the quality, increasing our absorption. Not even just increasing things, but just paying more attention, perhaps. But it's according to the level of where the devotee is at. I think for somebody who's on a Kanishtha platform, there would be a different answer than for somebody who's on the Madhyam platform. That's also described by the Acharyas. There's different rules. Bhaktivinoda Thakur describes that there's different rules for different devotees at each different stage. So So also you have to give up the other rules once you progress in your spiritual life. And yeah, that's as generic as I can say. Sri Bhaktialoka, he comments his commentary on the Nectar of Instruction by Rupa Goswami. He describes that, I think, and he comments on the third verse of the Nectar of Instruction, Atyahara Prayasachcha, like the different. The six things that are beneficial for our spiritual life. He describes it there. Or somebody wants to say something else about that particular point, maybe? Somebody has some more insights? Or... Okay, Prue? Okay, thank you for mentioning that. Go ahead. Commenting on having pet animals. Actually, Prabhupada comments on that also later on in the coming chapters. Prabhupada talks about that actually people have. You know, pet animals because they replace like relationships, and they get attached to the animals. And actually, he says that you know, he actually says like what to speak of somebody who becomes attached to a dog or a cat, and then in their next life they take the body of a dog or a cat, just because we get so absorbed in thinking about them. So, but what exactly did you want to? The extent of having pet animals. Does anybody remember what Prabhupada, if Prabhupada talks about that further? Does anybody have a reference from Prabhupada? That's the extent of our attachment. Just feed them prasadam because they can. Lord Chaitanya, he accepted having a dog around, you know, like when Shrivas Thakur? Shivananda Sen, thank you, Kurnamai. Shivananda Sen, he would take up the pilgrimage groups every year. And, you know, we know the story that there's one dog one time, and, you know, the devotees, you know, they tolerated him around. He was there, but, you know, didn't pay particular attention to him. But then Lord Chaitanya, he actually gave remnants, and then the devotee, you know, had some ecstatic symptoms and back to Godhead. So yeah, that's I think the extent of our involvement with pet animals. I think the danger for us is to replace, and it's not just pet animals. I think it's anything in this material world. Hare Krishna. Any kind of relationship, any kind of material facilities, cars, houses, whatever. There's always the tendency to replace our relationship with Krishna and our longing for Krishna with those other objects. Like, you know, like when kids, for instance, they have, you know, this game where you have certain shapes and you put in like forms into the shapes, and then sometimes they put like squares into round shapes and then it doesn't fit, and so they try to you know, match the shapes, but oftentimes it doesn't work because they use the wrong shape. So sometimes also that's what we do. We have what Satchinanda Swami refers to as the Krishna-shaped hole in the heart, and then we try to push all sorts of forms in there, and it doesn't quite work because, or it doesn't completely satisfy us because it doesn't really satisfy our desires. And I think the same with, you know, pets also. Sometimes, you know, it becomes our best friend, and you know, our shelter, our emotional shelter. A dog becomes our emotional shelter. That's a danger that's there. And then, you know, we're trying to replace our relationship with Krishna with those different relationships. And then, you know, we meditate on it, and, you know, we take birth as a dog in our next life because we become so attached. It's really more an internal question, like how, what's your internal relationship? I mean, like, well, how do you see internally the relationship? I mean, there's nothing wrong with animals. I mean, they're just also living entities. But, I don't know, just some thoughts. Somebody else? Thank you for bringing this up. And I think there's two points here, two important points that you mentioned. One is that even though we do deviate or whatever, I mean, it's not... And Bharat Maharaj didn't actively commit an offense, right? So there's always the door. You know, we can always... You know, Krishna's always giving us opportunities to rectify. And I think the other point is that if you see somebody else deviating, it's not our position to judge that person. And that's actually dangerous, like, to... Yeah, to judge about somebody else's performance. These are two important points that you mentioned here. Thank you. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Gantara Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai. Ananta Koti Vaishnava Vrinda ki jai. Gaura Prima.